Looking to start a podcast but don't know where to begin? Look no further. The team at Dodge Media Productions has 20 years of experience as podcast listeners and observing the industry and 8 years experience in podcast production. We can help you take your podcast from idea to fruition and we'll make the process seamless and easy. We'll help you with everything from recording and editing to hitting the charts on Apple Podcasts. So what are you waiting for? Contact us today and let's get started. DodgeMediaProductions.com.
You're listening to Dodge Movie Podcast. Your hosts are Christy and Mike Dodge, the founders of Dodge Media Productions. We produce films and podcasts, so this is a podcast about films. Join them as they share their passion for filmmaking.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Dodge Movie Podcast. This is episode 163, and we will be talking about the 1999 film, The Sixth Sense. We watched this film on Apple. We forked over $4 to watch it. It is written and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. He wrote this film with Bruce Willis in mind, who stars in the film as Malcolm Crowe. Haley Joel Osment is Cole Sear. His mom is portrayed by Toni Collette, Lynn Sear, and Bruce Willis's wife is played by Olivia Williams. And we also have Donnie Wahlberg in this film playing Vincent Gray. M. Night did in 1998 Wide Awake with Rosie O'Donnell and another 10-year-old little boy. And then after this film, he did Unbreakable, I believe, with Bruce Willis again, correct?
Yeah, it was Willis, yeah. If I recall, yeah.
In 2002, he did Signs. 2004, he did The Village. 2006, he did The Lady in the Water. And then most recently in 23, he did Knock at the Cabin. And he wrote all of those as well. The DP was Tak Fujimoto, who started in the 1970s with films like Chicago Blues, Cannonball Run. He Ooh. Also is credited. I know, right? I thought I told you that when we were watching it.
I don't remember that.
Oh, maybe I was saving it for the pod.
For the pod.
It says that he did Star Wars in 77.
What I read, there was another person listed as a cinematographer, but maybe he was a camera op or something.
Yeah, camera op maybe. Pretty in Pink in 86. Also Ferris Bueller's Day Off in 86 and Something Wild. He was very busy in 86.
Yeah. Well,
holy cow.
I guess maybe for a below the line person.
Maybe I was looking at, I'm almost positive I double checked all of these and they were under cinematography. So I will make sure and make corrections if I did in fact make a mistake, but we have him 88, also Cocoon, 91, Silence of the Lambs, like huge films that we've all heard of, 93, Philadelphia, your favorite, 97, A Thousand Acres, and he returned to work with M. Night in Signs in 2002, and then his films like kind of stopped, I want to say, after that. And so I was really curious, and he retired in 2015. So I don't know what he did from 2002 to 2015, but maybe there was some films that I just didn't make note of.
Right. Perhaps he counted his money. I don't know.
I know. I hope that's what he did. The synopsis for this film, if you're living under a rock, is Malcolm Crowe, a child psychologist, starts treating a young boy, Cole, who encounters dead people and convinces him to help them. In turn, Cole helps Malcolm reconcile with his estranged wife.
Okay, I guess we should say, spoiler, we're going to talk about spoilers. This is one of the more famous movies of all time with spoilers. So if you haven't seen it already and you don't want to be spoiled, stop the podcast until you watch it.
Right. The tagline kind of gives it, I mean,
yeah, that's why I butted in.
Yeah. The tagline, I mean, I have many taglines and I think there have probably been re-releases and maybe anniversaries for this film. So the first one is I See Dead People.
Okay. That's a winner right there. Right.
The next one is 1, sight, 2, sound, 3, smell, 4, taste, 5, touch, 6, the sixth sense. That's a horrible thing.
It's horrible. Somebody needs to use the Friedkin forehand on that marketing guy.
Not every gift is a blessing.
Okay. Again, all of these are like skiing uphill against I See Dead People.
Discover the secret of the sixth sense. That's a good one because it was kept secret. Bruce Willis mentioned in one of the videos I watched that he was so surprised how people didn't spoil this for their friends. And even like how everybody played along, like the industry, like you think of the marketing machine and the Entertainment Tonight's and the right. Very good. And, you know, all of the articles written and all of the reviews, you know, everybody kept this secret for people. This one, and I felt like the Crying Game, people kind of like they wanted everyone to get to enjoy the big reveal, and they kept this secret.
That's a really interesting question. Was that, I think it was, but was that just because this was such a darn good film that people didn't want to spoil it?
Has there been something like that recently? I can't think of anything.
No.
Where people... Because like even the other day, I won't do it again, but, or maybe I already did in a podcast, but somebody spoiled Poor Things. Or no, Anatomy of a Fall. Mm. At the Oscars, one of the actors said something and I was like, okay, thank you. Now,
yeah, so-and-so I know the is end of that the villain film. Or dies or you know what Rosebud is or whatever.
Yeah, it was just like, come on. I mean, not all of us have seen... I know you all get the screeners sent to your house, but the rest of us either have to wait for it to come on streaming.
But that's a good point, though, because if you're a savvy media interviewee, you would know to tease and not to reveal, especially in it's too close to when it came out.
Right.
Yeah, that was poor form.
There are ghosts walking among us looking for help. They have found it.
That's spoiler-y horrible.
Yeah, that kind of does spoil it, doesn't it?
And not very interesting.
Okay, do you believe now?
Ugh.
Can you keep the secret?
Okay, but it doesn't tell me anything about the film.
Right. Now you believe in ghosts.
No, don't like it.
America's number one movie, 4 weeks in a row.
That's horrible.
And the next one's very similar. The number one thriller of all time. A little bit of trivia before you kick us off. This film was filmed in sequence.
Which I like.
I like, but as a producer makes me bananas. But actually, we were talking over breakfast, I think the day after we watched this, and I realized not many of the locations are ever filmed again, really. Right. I mean, a couple that you could kind of control. Malcolm's house.
Right.
And... maybe Cole and Lynn's house, but different parts of it. So,
and those could be sound stages, which they control.
Which they can control.
So to repeat what I said during the pre-production meal, I think that was very smart of Shyamalan with such a young actor, because I feel like it would be harder for someone who is earlier in their career to match the tone if you shot out of sequence. Like Kathleen Turner did for Romancing the Stone, which we've already talked about several times. But just with a young actor, I think that made sense.
Except for Haley, after watching this film and watching Forrest Gump and then watching interviews with Bruce and Tony and M. Night, this kid is like a phenom. Like he is such a... And Tony said, like, he's a kid. Like, I see him out with the other kids and he's being a normal kid. But this kid is like... no other kid I've ever met before. Like, he was very adult in his ability. And even watching him in interviews, I mean, he had been working since he was 6 years old. So by the time he made this, he had been on the Jeff Foxworthy show. He had done Forrest Gump. He had done a couple other movies and maybe a couple other TV shows. Like, oh, he goes, and then I have a reoccurring on, like... I can't remember what movie. And so that's where I was just like, holy cow, who is this kid? Like, like Boston, it was like, it wasn't Boston Legal, but it was like, and then I have a reoccurring on Murphy Brown. That's what it was.
If you have 8 credits on IMDb, you might be an actor.
I know. He's just amazing. So this film established M. Night as a writer and director and introduced the cinema public to his traits, most notably his affinity for surprise endings. And the movie's line, "I see dead people," was voted as number 44 movie quote by the AFI's out of 100. Yeah. All right. So kick us off with your pickup line for the film The Sixth Sense.
It's getting cold.
Ooh, that's...
So it's spoken by Bruce Willis's character's wife, Anna Crowe, played by Olivia Williams. who, by the way, I first really recognized in Dollhouse, Joss Whedon's TV show, which at the time doesn't land particularly, but as we find the rules of the story, then that is talking about Kez Kold is associated with ghosts being around. So that does make sense.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah. It gets in on technicality.
Yep. So the cinematography of this film, I felt like most of the colors were muted, except for M. Night has a director's trademark of using the color red.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about the only...
Yeah, I felt like the red was pulled up, maybe. And I'm pretty sure this was shot on film, not digitally.
I would agree.
I felt like the beginning of the movie, there was a lot of grain, but I didn't notice it later in the film. So I don't know if that was a choice or if I just miscalled the first part of the film.
I would agree. I felt like it was somewhat grainy and muted. If I didn't know it was Philadelphia, I would have said it, you know, it was shot in Seattle or something.
Right,
with
kind
of like a very, although when you think back at like Rocky and, I thought of another movie earlier today that was shot in Philly, but
Philadelphia.
There you go. That's it.
Trading Places, maybe. We talked about that recently, and I thought that was Philly.
And it very much has like that overcast look to it.
Oh, good job, Philly. Nice lighting.
Yeah, I wonder where they are, like
latitudinally.
Yeah. Are they similar?
Right. Like, and they're on the water.
Yeah,
maybe that affects it too. Yeah.
The scene, okay, so let's just kick off because it does happen early in the film where Vincent is, because I'm so impressed by Donnie Wahlberg, although a little worried about him at the same time. So he knew he wanted to drop some weight because he knew he wanted to have a different appearance than his, you know, his kind of the way he looks. So he said he started cutting weight. And he wanted to drop like 10 or 15 pounds and he did it within like the first 3 weeks and he still had weeks to go before the filming. And so he had to kind of just keep going, dangerously so.
Right.
I think he went a little too far. He dropped like 40 pounds and he said he ate the very next day after he finished filming.
Did he have a Whataburger?
Not until he finished filming.
Okay.
And then he went out and had a Whataburger. But he very much got in the mindset of, because I don't know if I put this together as much my first viewing, but this viewing I got that he and Cole shared the same ability.
Yeah. This is, so again, the parallels between the Vincent Gray character and the Cole character, I didn't catch the first time through at all.
I just thought he was another troubled kid that he helped.
Yeah. I didn't realize that he also saw ghosts.
He saw ghosts. And this is what I did not even get this last viewing. Remember when I asked you when Malcolm is listening to the cassette of the recording of a session with Vincent when he was younger, and he very much even almost sounded like Haley, like Cole.
Yeah, I thought at one point they actually had dialogue spoken by Haley.
Right, I did too. But it was supposed to be Vincent as a young boy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and maybe M. Night was just like, well, we need a young boy's voice. We have a young boy on set. Let's just have him do Vincent's dialogue.
Do we have a 10-year-old who's a fantastic actor? Yes, we do.
Right. So what, remember we heard another voice on that. And
correct.
You said that you thought it was the Latin.
But it was not.
It was not. Did you read the trivia?
I did.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if I saw this in the trivia, but in the video, that's somehow Malcolm captured one of the ghosts speaking,
right.
And so, it was the dead man who was speaking to Vincent.
Okay, so if you know him, do you call him M or Knight or M. Knight?
They
or
would call him, I thought people called him Knight.
Okay, so I want to, I have a bone to pick with him about this. I think the film is really well plotted in every other regard, but I had a problem with that little scene there for two reasons. One, I could not hear the Spanish, so I didn't know what was going on. I thought they were trying to tell us, but the point is, at no other point in the film does anyone but Haley Joel Osment hear a ghost. And in fact, in the rules of the universe, the ghosts can't see each other. So,
is that why Malcolm can hear it? Because he's dead.
But the rules of the universe, as Haley Joel in the hospital tells him, is that
the ghosts can't see each other.
So, it serves a purpose to help us think, oh my gosh, maybe this Vincent guy was the same, but that wasn't explained to me.
Yeah, but you did. Yeah. I mean, not to get nitpicky because...
Right, not to get nitpicky.
Yeah.
I think the film is incredibly well put together.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was lost on me, even if it was in the... you know, in alignment with the what do you guys call it? The canon. Like, even if it was part of the rules, it was lost on me. Because like you said, we couldn't understand it. I couldn't tell if it was a foreign language.
Right.
And somebody said something in one of the videos I watched that the man is saying how much he didn't want to die.
Right.
And so I was like, but if it's in, like you said, Spanish or Latin, how would we know that?
Right. And I can understand some Spanish. I didn't even catch that it was Spanish. So, yeah. And maybe that was just our recording had that. Maybe the audio was better in the theater.
It'd be curious if we had turned on captions, what the captions would have said.
Right.
To see if it wasn't Spanish. Was it Latin?
I wonder if the captions were written by that one guy who did like the undulating Wetly captions or something.
Now I'm going to have to. There's a great Sunday morning thing about sound in movies that I'll put in the show notes. It was fantastic. I let Mike listen to it and that's what he's referring to. Okay. So is there anything else about the Vincent scene? Whoa, this is the other thing. Knight was so impressed with Donnie Wahlberg because of the amount of time and energy that he put into playing Vincent for 5 minutes on screen. Like for weeks, he abused his body basically to get it down. And then like psychologically, he kept thinking if he was watching kind of like Haley act and watching what Cole was going through. And then if now Vincent's a teenager or a young man, to have lived with that and not have any reprieve. And so he talked about like he went out and he took a buddy and they went out at night into Philadelphia and they just were walking around and the buddy played Cole's part and they were just improvising like, what would this be like, you know? And at one point he realized, oh no, Vincent wouldn't have any friends. And so he just took off running and like left his buddy and then just kind of like hid in different places in Philadelphia and stayed out for most of the night. And he said, even though I knew I could go back to the hotel and order room service, I didn't because I knew Vincent wouldn't, like, you know, that's where actors, you know, you kind of go like, okay.
I was just thinking, hey, Jimmy, didn't you go for a walk with Donnie? Yeah. Where's Donnie? I don't know.
He ran away.
He ran away again? Yeah.
And so I just, like, poor Donnie. Like, I think, but, and then the scene when he yells at Bruce right before he shoots, or Malcolm, right before he shoots him, he said he got so into it. Like he even surprised himself, but he was really feeling how Vincent would feel. And the gun didn't have any blanks in it, but he wasn't supposed to shoot the gun, but he did point it at Bruce and shoot it. And they probably had to do it again, but he was so in the moment that he went ahead and kind of like skipped ahead to a scene that they, so anyway, like he commitment. Like, whether it be right or wrong, commitment and props to him because he transformed. I mean, if you hadn't told me that was Donnie Wahlberg, I would have said, like, this is an actor I've never seen before.
When I saw the film, I didn't recognize him. And it was only later that I read the trivia. I'm like, oh, that was Donnie Wahlberg? Huh.
It's wild.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. Enough on that scene.
Yeah.
I liked Cole's line early on. I think he's talking to Malcolm. And he says, they don't have meetings about rainbows.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot of levity in this film, but that was a moment where he was kind of a little sarcastic or a little, cheeky.
Interesting. I didn't take it as sarcastic. I just took it as he was, well, I discovered they don't have meetings about rainbows.
Yeah.
Like, if I draw that, right? Which...
Oh, that's right. That's when he said it.
That makes the most sense to me because the kid's smart.
And he is really smart.
So he immediately realizes, oh, if I let this out, the parents, the adults freak out. So,
right. If I draw what's really happening in my mind, they get really, but if I draw rainbows, nobody calls a meeting.
Right.
That's right. I forgot that's what he was talking about. I thought he was talking about the ghosts don't get together and have meetings about rainbows. But
that would be fun if the ghosts had meetings.
Okay. Character development. There's a lot of character development with, I would say, all characters.
Yeah, my immediate thought was not so much with Lynn, Cole's mother, but maybe...
No, because she becomes...
She does kind of see...
She believes him. I mean, and I think she wanted to... Maybe she didn't want to believe him. She definitely was a devoted mother that wanted to help her son. That's for sure. She didn't know what was going on, and he wouldn't tell her because he didn't want to worry her. But then at the end, when he talks about her mother, she realizes what's going on.
Yeah, she comes around. Anna, Malcolm's wife, I guess she gets the closure she needs, right? Obviously, Malcolm gets the closure he needs. Mm-hmm. And we're led to believe that Cole... at least get some sort of peace with his gift. If not, I never got the sense that he would no longer see dead people, but it was like he now knew why. And so he would be able to, like I said, some sort of peace with it, at least. Tommy Tomasino did not have character development, that little shit. He's the bully who locks Cole in the closet.
Oh.
And he really doesn't. So I'm not too keen with that.
You're not holding a grudge or anything. I didn't even know that kid had a name.
Yeah, and the kid who played him, he went on to have another acting career. I mean, he continued acting. And I think we've probably seen him in some other stuff. So, again, running the risk of getting Bradley Cooper'd, but I think because it was when he was a kid, I wouldn't recognize him as an adult.
Right. Good luck, or good for him.
Yeah, lucky for him. Yeah.
yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. I love the scene where Malcolm is asking him questions. The audience is supposed to think this is the first time they're meeting, and maybe it is. But I love how M. Night, when he didn't get the question right, and so he takes a step backward, he moves the camera. So we feel the distance growing, and we feel, in his words in one of the videos I watched, that Malcolm is losing his grasp on to Cole because he's stepping back.
Right. And they have the ECU on his little feet.
Mm-hmm.
That was masterful. That scene is so good.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm sure someone else has, but I can't remember before that a shot of that. And then just the idea of that game of like forward and back. I don't know if anybody's ever used that.
Child psychologist uses that.
But that was, it was like cinematographically, it works brilliant.
Yeah, it was
There's
great.
There's movement in a scene that's really just psychological. Oh, that was so well done.
I know, really well done. Another one of M. Night's director's trademarks is putting himself in the film. And he dislikes this part, so he cut most of it out from the final print. But he often portrays a doctor, apparently, because his family is loaded with doctors. And since he didn't go in that route, he puts himself as the doctor in a lot of his films, which I haven't seen too many of his films, so I don't know, but other people might. I'll put this in the show notes. There was this great part of a deleted scene that they left out, because as you have talked about many times when we think of this film, that you were always, you know, stunned that the filmmakers, they thought the whole time that everybody would get the secret before it was revealed, because to them it seems so obvious. And one of the things is the toy soldiers that we saw a little bit.
Right.
You see Cole he talks to Malcolm about two of them and tells specifics that no other child would really know about.
Oh, I didn't even get that until you just said that.
No, they deleted that scene.
Oh, okay. Okay.
That's what you wouldn't have gotten.
I'm not as dumb as I thought.
No. They deleted a scene where he's speaking specifically. He has two soldiers and he's like, do you want to be like, I'm just going to make up names like Robbie Williams, or do you want to be this one? And he's like, well, what do you know about them? And then he says like, well, he died. His wife was pregnant. He wanted to get back in time for the birth. And like, he's just talking about things that like a kid wouldn't.
A little bit of that bled through though, because when he says Latin, do all the soldiers speak Latin? And Cole says, no, just one. So we kind of see now that makes sense where that line comes from.
Yeah. It was fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wish I had had more time to kind of do a deep dive because this movie is, you know, 18 years old.
I would love to do like D for Five with Knight.
Yes.
And dig into this. There's so much about this. Again, mad props to him. What an inventive story, but cleverly plotted. I knew the secret going in this viewing, right? And I was watching, I was looking for things where they tipped their hand and I never found any. It is so well done.
It really is.
Like, so as a writer, director, editor, like I understand this fear that people would get it, because even just with the writing process, by the time you're done with your screenplay, you have gone over it over and over and over again. And I'm sure based on how well this movie was plotted, that he had the specific lines in there was set for a specific reason to foreshadow a thing. And so it's just dead obvious to him. Like immediately every scene is obvious what is going on. And then to go through shooting it and editing it, sitting on the couch for weeks, I could see how he would come away thinking, this is so obvious.
It's so obvious. Yeah.
2 seconds into the film, they're going to know the gag and I'm going to be the laughing stock. I guarantee you that's what it would feel like. So in some sense, we have to give him credit for having the intestinal fortitude to take this film all the way through.
Especially because he spoke that this is like, I don't know, the third or fourth draft. He had kind of the story. He had this idea, but he couldn't. He goes, it was garbage, so I had to throw it away. And I wrote, you know, like another one. And then he was like, and that was garbage, so I threw it away. And he really beat his head against the wall to get this film to where it is. And so, yeah, it's so well done. And I think sadly for him, because of how well done it was and because of what a success it was, it feels like I said, I don't think I've watched any of the other films. Did you watch Unbreakable? I thought you did.
I don't think I did.
Oh, okay. It feels like society, what I hear, are very critical of every film he's ever tried to do after that.
Right. We talked about this. Was it in some sense a curse that I thought it was his first film, but apparently it's his second. But right out of the gate, you land a film this good. The expectations are high. How can you ever get back to that?
I wish that this was more my genre, because I love Bryce Dallas Howard, so I'd love to watch The Lady in the Water. It looks way too spooky and too nerve-wracking for me, but I like the actors that are in Knock on the Cabin or Knock at the Cabin, the one that just came out last year. It's the one where it's a gay
couple. Bautista?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Again,
I know.
Film, I just want to read the synopsis.
Yeah, but I want to root for him. And then I like the idea of Unbreakable. And then I don't know about Signs.
I would say, looking, not to compare him too unfavorably, but like looking at Hitchcock, right? Hitchcock was known for suspense, but his films were kind of all over the map in the sense that not everyone had a surprise twist ending, right? I think that's maybe one of the things that Knight is fighting against, is everyone has a twist ending. So it's like going into it, you know, oh, there's going to be a twist ending.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do that.
So that's the beauty of this one, it being his first.
Right. And didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
But again, it is so incredibly well plotted. I remember Pete Jones from the first season of Greenlight talked about sitting in his underpants in the middle of the night typing in his, you know, screenplay. I can see M. Night doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, he's obsessive.
Months at a time. Like, his wife or partner or whomever has gone to bed, and he's lit only by the screen of his iMac.
Yeah.
And he's pounding away. Like, this film feels like that amount of polish went into it. So then, can you do that for every film? And then it's magic in a bottle, right? Some people never get it in their career. So how do we, you know, do we expect, oh, well, your second album's going to be brilliant like your first? Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to follow that up.
All right. If anybody out there has another M. Night movie that we should take a stab at, either on the podcast or just watch, let us know. If you,
I think we've got a super fan that likes Unbreakable.
I thought this was fascinating. He said, and he learned this from working on, was it called Awakenings? What was Wide Awake with, Rosie, he, and another 10-year-old kid. He said, he told Haley, I don't ever want you to look sad. You can look angry. You can look fearful. You can look confused, you know, all the emotions, but not sad. Because he says, when the audience sees you sad, how did he explain it? Because it was amazing. It was like, they go with you with sad, but then they're like, okay, now what do you got? Like, you can only go to that sad well, I think, once.
Yeah.
And then you've got to kind of show them more. And so, like, for that's why the scene where he leaves his bedroom and goes, I think, into the bathroom, and then like the ghosts go into his bedroom or something, and he goes, he runs and he goes into his tent where they aren't, and he's angry at himself because he's like, I had a rule, I knew my rule, I broke my rule, and look what happened. And so he didn't want him to look sad in that scene. He wanted, and so he was like, how would Cole feel? And so they came up with angry. And so that's why he expressed anger. And so I just thought, found that fascinating. And I think it is that why this, another reason why this film works is because it wasn't like the audience, I mean, the audience probably felt bad for Cole that he's having to deal with this, but it kept us in our own kind of state of what would it be like, instead of the empathy that we maybe would.
Right. I was going to say, normally you think a 10-year-old child in an uncomfortable situation, your paternal or maternal instinct would kick in, and it didn't in this film. And as you were talking, I was thinking about why is that? And I think part of it is because they make Cole kind of the creepiest thing on screen. And part of that maybe is to not be sad.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And maybe he wouldn't be sad because he's living it, you know? So day in and day out, like,
yeah,
you would have gone past the emotion of sad. You would be maybe like angry and fearful and just annoyed. Right. Like, I don't want this voice. I don't want to hear you. I don't want to see the back of your gross head.
But I think PTSD, because of that never ending waiting for the other shoe to drop, right?
You wouldn't go into sad.
No.
No.
You would dissociate.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't be sad.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Again.
I know. It was fascinating listening to... This is why I love listening to filmmakers talk about their process, because they think about it to the nth degree that nobody else would.
Right. So to segue, I think it is a travesty that Michael Caine got the Oscar this year and for Cider House Rules and not Haley Joel Osment for Sixth Sense.
The year that we're talking about, not this year. I was like, Michael Caine didn't
get it. Yeah, the year of this film.
Yeah.
Cider House Rules, fine film, I guess. I don't know. Topher Grace, maybe?
It was. No, I don't.
Who is that?
I don't.
Somebody.
Jake Gyllenhaal. I think it was Jake Gyllenhaal.
But no.
Down Roadhouse.
This performance by Haley Joel Osment is incredible.
It's
and to,
astounding.
From a 10 or 11, I think he was 11 years old. Just incredible. The kid deserved the award.
Yeah. Well, and then, I mean, skipping ahead a little bit in my notes, I just saw, and you saw this in the trivia too, M. Night knew that he was the one when in his audition,
I love this.
M. Night said something like, you know, you really know this part really well. And he was like, well, I read it 3 times last night. And he's like, you read your part 3 times? And he goes, no, I read the whole script 3 times. And he was just like, okay, you get the part.
Yeah. I have to say, and as a person who has written screenplays, I like when they're like, no, I read your writing 3 times last night. That is a great way to get a part. Because they're like, ooh. Yeah, no, again, for a young person, the level of commitment. But like you mentioned with Donnie, another thing I found amazing about this was kind of Bruce Willis at the height of his maybe career, his star power, right? And I know him mostly as, you know, John McClane, yippee-ki-yay, and this is not that, right? This is not an action film. This is a psychological thriller.
Right. Which is one of the things M. Night said. He didn't want him to be able to rely on that kind of, like, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like dude power, like just, you know, like superhero, mm-hmm. like, you know.
Yeah, macho action hero. Yeah,
he wanted him to have to just kind of have that quiet presence.
And I think Bruce Willis did a fine job in this role. I don't know that I would have thought when we were casting this, we had to get Willis in here.
Yeah, but he wrote it with him in mind.
Right. And what I find fascinating about that, because I haven't, you know, interacted with Bruce Willis in his acting chops, and maybe M. Night had.
Yeah.
Or he saw something that I didn't see.
He hadn't.
But of course, the cynic in me, the producer, says, well, Willis puts butts in seats.
He was. He was definitely during that time.
So that's not bad for your film to have Bruce Willis headlining it. This was before, I think, Toni Collette was much of, you know, a name for most people. I don't know where this lands in her career, but
it was pretty soon after Muriel's wedding, and there was something else she was in, but she was pretty young. Yeah. Oh, she tells a story. She was up for a part in a Scorsese film, and so she went for a walk. She was kind of like, okay, I've done all I can do. Like, you know, in the audition, I just have to wait for the results. So she was walking around, I think, New York City or something. And back then they didn't have cell phones. And so she went into a phone booth and called the hotel and said, can you play me my messages? And they did. And she could hear her agents and everybody like, oh my God. And they're so excited. So she goes back to the hotel and she calls them like, okay, what's going on? Mm-hmm. And they were like, yeah, you didn't get the part in the Scorsese film, but you got the Sixth Sense. And she was just like, okay, well, what's that?
You know, right. Oh, fantastic. Going back to cinematography for a second, we often see tilting up and down, but we rarely see the pedestal where the camera remains on the horizontal plane, but just moves up or down. Mm. And we see that in the opening shot with Anna on the other side of the wine bottles.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was an interesting shot. There is a lot of reflections, mm-hmm. right? There was them, Malcolm and Anna, reflected in the framed plaque. That was a curious choice, right, in that kind of first scene where things get cold. There's her showering, and he sees her in the reflection of the mirror. There's a couple of doorknob reflections.
I wonder, were the doorknob reflections people? Because is that people that are alive? Because then there's that scene with Lynn, and she's in the hallway, and she's looking, and she's noticing all of, like, the glares or the orbs that are in the pictures with Cole.
Yeah, it's interesting. It looks like a lens flare, but she's reacting to it like
she knows something was there.
It's creepy.
Yeah.
And so I think that is an interesting kind of, there's always been this motif, like vampires can't be seen in mirrors, and mirrors are kind of creepy when you stop and think about it. Cause like you can see yourself and like a person's on your left instead of your right. And I don't know, I think there's something kind of at our lizard or monkey brain that doesn't like mirrors so much, the reflections. And that's kind of interesting. So there is a great shot where the first time we see Cole go to school and he's outside, and they shoot from inside in the hallway and they expose for the exterior. So it's like black and it's just a frame. It was a really nice shot, especially with the saturation. Then we talked about the scene with their feet and the game. I think that was pretty good. I thought it was interesting, the camera movement when Malcolm joins Anna for dinner. So it's like continuous but slow movement. It kind of like dollies back and then it pans and then it keeps moving. So it was all really slow but continuous motion, which again, for a film that is inherently kind of talky and thoughty, it's good to give that. There's that spiral staircase where they lock Cole in the top. And so that was neat that they shoot down that. I think you can't have a spiral staircase and not shoot down it or up it.
They also shot up as the balloon goes up.
Oh, right. Yeah. There is a really interesting camera movement when Cole and his mom are sitting at the table. They're having dinner and they're talking about the bumblebee pendant. And so it pans back and forth. And it was really kind of fascinating. Tip of the cap to the cinematographer, because at points it's like only Cole, and then it's the both of them, and then it's only Lynn. And so I thought that was really fascinating to show the evolution of that conversation. We also see there's the whole scene with the ring from shot from inside the jewelry case, right? And obviously that couple there only serves it as someone for Anna to talk to. Mm-hmm. And
I felt like those were probably family members of the director.
Oh, you're right. They did sound like they might come from that part of the world. One thing that I didn't know how they did, I mean, obviously they could, but it was fascinating. There's a shot in Cole's tent, and it's like the camera dollies and then tilts vertical and then pushes down. And I don't even know how they got, because you can see that the tent is still there, the blanket. So wow. I don't know how they did that. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I would think they could do it like with a GoPro or something. But back then, I don't know. And then my last little bit was, as we've established before, I'm very sensitive about my own abilities to focus. So I'm hypersensitive to focus issues in films. And there is a line where Cole delivers, "How can you help me if you don't believe me?" And there were some focus issues. And I said, I think that was a case of that was the circle take. So you lived with it because
absolutely.
That was the fantastic take.
Yep.
So that's what drives filmmakers crazy.
All right. Was there any head trauma in this film?
Well, Vincent shoots himself in the head.
Yeah.
So that counts.
Poor Vincent. Mm-hmm. Did we get a smooch at the beginning with Malcolm and his wife?
Smoochy, smoochy, smoochy. I actually counted a couple. So there is a smooch between them in the opening scene. They also smooch in the wedding video. So we see that a couple of times. And then, not so special mention, Cheese Dick almost smooches Anna in the store.
How about a driving review in this film?
So there wasn't a whole lot of driving. I would say the green 83 Volvo GL wagon that she drives is 16 years old at the time of the filming and quite sensible. So that kind of matches with the rest of her character. And then I will mention that there's only one Dodge in this film, and that's the one that gets totaled in that last scene. So thanks, Knight.
Maybe, yeah, he's not a fan, doesn't sound like.
Right.
All right, so we go to the numbers.
Let's go to the numbers.
The film was a sleeper hit in the year 1999. It was in Entertainment Weekly's 134 film summer preview of 1999. The Sixth Sense wasn't even mentioned on the list, but positive word of mouth contributed to its financial success with reports of people watching it twice due to the surprise ending. And when it was released on VHS and DVD, kids, look those up, what they were. by Hollywood Pictures Home Video. On March 28th in the year 2000, it would go on to become the top-selling DVD of 2000 with more than 2.5 million units shipped, as well as the top video rental of all time, which they can say now because nobody rents movies anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Somebody will hold that title forever.
Yeah. After a 6-month online promotion campaign, The Sixth Sense was released on VHS and DVD. Like I said, the film generated at least $173.3 million $1,000 from the U.S. home video market, which is equivalent to almost $300,000 today. And it also got quite a sizable sum in the UK. It is the third most watched film of 2003 on television, with 9 million viewers that year. It surpassed Jaws from 1975 as the highest grossing horror film, and it held that record for nearly 20 years until it was surpassed by It in 2017. M. Night became the sixth person nominated for an Academy Award for Best Director before the age of 30. The other previous five were Orson Welles, Claude Lelouch, George Lucas, Kenneth Branagh, and John Singleton, who were all in their 20s.
Pretty good company.
So now to our normal. This film had a budget of $40 million, and it made domestically $293.5 million, and then worldwide $379.3 million. It has an 8.2 out of 10 on IMDb. Critics give it an 86%. Audiences liked it a bit more at 90%. And it is, let's see, the length is 1 hour, 47 minutes. So a little bit past the Moro line.
Yeah, it's about 21 minutes past the Moro line.
Okay. But would you cut anything?
Nope.
Yeah.
Not this film.
Yeah. I'd be curious what he would agree with that.
Yeah, I would be as well.
I'll have to ask him next time.
Previous films we've looked at, have a lot of them have been long, where I just like, we gotta get out of here. I don't feel like this film had any problems in Act Two. It was moving along. It was paced very well.
Yep. It was PG-13. It's a drama mystery thriller. It is a Hollywood picture Spyglass Entertainment, and it won 37 awards with 56 nominations. So well done, M. Night.
And Haley Joel.
Yeah, I'm gonna try to push myself to watch another M. Night, see what I think.
Unbreakable is definitely the one that I hear the most good things about. Not as good as The Sixth Sense, but definitely.
I wonder what Hector and Ruthie from the Reshoot podcast, if they would, or Eduardo, if they would have a suggestion.
Could The Sixth Sense be one of the few films that Eduardo and I both like?
I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll have to find out.
I would think
next
he would like this film.
I would think so.
But my instincts are not often accurate with Eduardo, so maybe I'm wrong. And I'm curious how they would reshoot this, what you would do differently.
I should look and see if they did right. this one. I will look, right. and I will put it in our show notes. Another great movie podcast to listen to. All right, folks, let's see what we're going to watch next week. The film that we are going to watch in the first week of April will be...
Star Wars.
Ooh. All right. There you have it. Have a great weekend, and never forget,
Dodges never stop, and neither do the movies.
Thanks for listening to Dodge Movie Podcast with Christy and Mike Dodge of Dodge Media Productions. To find out more about this podcast and what we do, go to dodgemediaproductions.com. Subscribe, share, leave a comment, and tell us what we should watch next. Dodges never stop, and neither do the movies.